Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast. What a week. What a week. Did anyone see the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris?
I didn't see it live, but I was watching it all sort of play out via Twitter. So I was all up to date with all the memes that were going around about poor Bernie Sanders, who was just sitting there minding his own business during the whole thing with his mask on and his mittens. And now he's been photoshopped into loads of different scenarios. I probably had a different view of how things played out just through, because mine was filtered through, I guess, mischievous internet users, how things were going out, playing out live rather than someone who watched it on TV at home.
I was really pleasantly surprised to see Lady Gaga.
Oh, you're a little monster now, aren't you, Brian? After seeing her at the SAP conference.
After Sapphire. and J-Lo as well, of course. Singing a great song, This Land Is Our Land. And she also was at Sapphire, I remembered. She's done that gig. But yeah, Lady Gaga looked amazing and sang amazingly well. As did J-Lo. And I liked the way J-Lo broke into Spanish. I thought that was very cool. Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
And that young woman who read her poem, Amanda Gorman.
Yeah. And like, without detracting from what she said about, she's really raised the bar, I think, in terms of what my face covering should be like from now on. I really, really liked her face mask.
Yeah, no, it's very, very, very impressive. I think a lot of our American colleagues, not all of them, because some will be Republicans, have to remember that. But a fair few of them will be, you know, glad to move on from the Trump era. Yeah, and I think we feel much the same.
Glad
to see the back of the monster.
Well, I saw a tweet the other day by an author called Danny Wallace while the inauguration was going on, and he was just saying he's just really looking forward to not needing to know what any of the names of any of the people supporting Joe Biden is going to be in the Oval Office, because they'll just be so boring compared to Trump. Like, you don't need to keep tabs on any of them. They'll just get on with the job. We can all relax a bit, hopefully. But yeah, and I was like, yeah, that's true, actually. That why else, like, in no other era today in US politics were I ever known like the name of their chief of staff or anything like that, or like, you know, Anthony Scaramucci and this kind of stuff. Like,
yeah,
I shouldn't need to know these people, but yeah, but because of the Trump era, you sort of had to, like, oh god, what have they done now? Like, so hopefully it'll all be a bit more relaxed and chill.
Yeah, I guess we do keep a closer eye on America. I mean, A, we work for an American company, but B, we cover IT. But generally, we shouldn't have to be so involved in American politics, you know, psychologically as we have been. So hopefully it'll all just calm down a bit.
Yeah. And he looks to be, I'd say, make it, like, some of the choices he's made in terms of the decor and the Oval Office and just some of his statements so far, it does seem like maybe a bit, hopefully, a more progressive and inclusive sort of time in the White House now compared to what happened under Trump's watch as well.
What happened?
There's no way of summing it up without just being like, yeah, I'm gonna be polite. Yeah, just the unpleasantness, the happenings that went on under Trump's watch.
Yeah, Biden seems like a kind man as well. Well, let's get on with our own show today. Top line on the podcast, just to indicate where we're going. Caroline, you've had the joys of going through some Public Accounts Committee report.
The government bean counters have turned their attention to HMRC's kind of performance and various other markers of how they're doing, and have found that their IT systems are wanting of urgent attention, shall we say.
Interesting. Okay, more on that very soon. Claire, you're gonna pick up a topic from our diversity event.
Yes, I know that I was filling you guys in last year about some of the workshops that we did as a part of the diversity event. And this is the one that I didn't have time to talk about in 2020, but diversity is an ongoing topic. So 2021, best time ever to talk about neurodiversity in this case.
Cool, and more on that in a bit. I'm gonna well, this week I did a kind of up close and personal interview with Silicon Valley CEO Gaurav Dhillon, who's the CEO of SnapLogic. So I'm gonna kind of talk about some of the things he said, interesting character. Can delve into that towards the end of the podcast. But just kind of adverting back to the inauguration ceremony, the foundation of the United States of America began with a conflict between the colonists and His Majesty's Revenue and Customs, HMRC. Well, it wasn't called that then, but it was the government. Caroline, it's time to talk again about tax, but maybe with a different lens on it this time.
Yes, yeah. So usually when I talk about tax on the podcast, it is more about contractors and their various IT contractors and their various run-ins with HMRC. So, but this time it's more focused on HMRC internally and their systems and things like that. So let's get into the story. So the story is HMRC and its IT strategy basically came in for a bit of a critical mauling this week in a report by the Public Accounts Committee, who are, for the uninitiated, essentially a group of, I say bean counters, but they're basically tasked with overseeing government expenditure. And recently they've had HMRC in their crosshairs. And this work has included investigating whether the tax collection agency has had all the resources and capacity it needs to deliver on all the things it's promised to do, as well as some of the unexpected, I guess, responsibilities that have fallen into its lap of late, namely supporting the government with its various or coronavirus financial support schemes and stuff like that. But of most interest to us at Computer Weekly is the part of the report that really delved into HMRC's IT strategy, with the report flagging concerns about how much money has been spent on patching up its legacy systems rather than on modernising its IT for the future, as the report says. So why does that matter? Well, back in 2015, HMRC set itself the goal, it's quite a lofty goal, of becoming the most digitally advanced tax administration in the world. But if all your budget is being spent on patching up aging, decrepit IT systems, how are you supposed to go about achieving that? That's kind of the crux of this here. The thing that sort of struck me on this story is that why would you come up with such an ambitious goal when you probably got an inkling at the time that most of your IT budget and resources is being currently devoted to keeping the lights on rather than modernisation. And HMRC is renowned for probably having one of the most complex IT estates out of all the government departments out there. So it's just kind of like, why did they come out and say this? What were they doing in the background to kind of make sure they could deliver on this goal? So that's like kind of one of the questions that sprung to mind when I was writing up this story. And so while the 2015 goal is noble and ambitious, delivering on it was probably never going to be a walk in the park. And that's without factoring in sort of other recent events, world events that have come into play. You know, as I already alluded to, you know, no one saw the pandemic coming, for example. And on that point, the report from the Public Accounts Committee states the pandemic alone has resulted in HMRC's IT costs rising by £53.2 million. Within it, the report as well, it also goes on to acknowledge the huge strain COVID-19 has put on HMRC's day-to-day operations and the department's overall performance. So, for example, the report calls out the fact that the amount of tax that HMRC is collecting these days is way, way down on what it should be. Customer service levels are tanking and its compliance activity has markedly slowed down as well. So it's not having, I guess in terms of report cards, this isn't a great, not a great parents' evening going on for HMRC at the moment. So, but then on, like, in response to all that, you know, one could argue perhaps, you know, that there is less tax revenue coming in because the pandemic has caused the economy to tank. So is that really HMRC's fault? Customer service levels have dropped because HMRC is being pulled in so many different directions at the moment, you know, away from the pandemic and all the support it's offering the government with its own coronavirus support schemes. HMRC has also had to ready IT systems to accommodate the changes to import and export taxes and VAT that's all been brought about by Brexit as well. And so, you know, if you look back to when they stated that goal, that they wanted to become the most digitally advanced tax administration in the world, there was no pandemic going on. And also the EU referendum vote didn't happen until 2016. So they couldn't have seen that on the horizon either. So, but it doesn't matter. The committee isn't going to let HMRC shirk on any of its responsibilities. So they've given HMRC until the end of 2021 to provide details about how it plans to refocus its IT strategy away from patching up things and move more towards modernisation. Yeah, so HMRC have already said that, you know, in response to that, they've secured additional funding for their IT through the spending review. And they've also received word from the government that they're going to get more money to support its ongoing sort of making tax digital push as well. I mean, but what all this story does bring to mind, though, is that there's lots of other instances. You can go through the Computer Weekly archives and there is story after story about public sector IT modernization projects and upgrades that have ended up swallowing money with very little to show for it. So I don't know, just reading all this, I am a bit like, so is throwing more money at these problems the way to fix it, you know, given all the various ways in which HMRC's in-house resources are being stretched at the moment? But I guess, as ever, we'll just have to wait and see. But it's you can kind of see, looking through the report, like I say, that it's easy to sort of look at bits and think, okay, that sounds really damning, but you've got to look at the wider context of what HMRC as an organization is dealing with at the moment. The pandemic is a very good example, and there are figures in the report which I can't pull to mind at the moment, but just sort of stating like just the number of like thousands of employees there who are all working on one task on the day to day, and then suddenly almost overnight have had to shift over to suddenly you've got to support people who are handling furlough payments and, you know, that kind of thing. And it's, yeah, it's a huge shift. And at the same time, when they probably haven't been given budget, I guess, to recruit lots of people to do this kind of work, and they've all had to, like many others, react to work at home orders and things like that as well. It's a huge undertaking, but like I say, they're still, you know, tax has still got to be brought in, they still need to, you know, work smoothly. So yeah, gotta tidy up their IT.
It's a massive, complex department, isn't it? Mm. I got a sense of this. I attended a Tech UK event in September, at which various government CIOs were speaking, including the CDIO, so Chief Digital and Information Officer for HMRC. He was interim. Mm. This was Mark Denny. And so he was a little bit demob happy because he wasn't doing that job now. One of the things that really struck me is that so the COVID projects, they sounded quite fun in a way, because he was talking about being in a room with Rishi and they were brainstorming, and, you know, it was that thing of you know, a project that was taking 9 months, we did in 24 hours.
Oh, COVID, yeah.
You know, and all that stuff. So the job retention scheme, what was it called? Eat Out to Help Out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff was done in a very agile, modern IT kind of manner. But he was definitely, although he'd had that job, albeit on an interim basis, was also saying, you know, it's really static and bureaucratic and there's so much technical debt. And to get rid of it would be tantamount to a revolution and things like that. I mean, they've got a new CDIO in there now, Daljit Rehal, from used to be at Centrica. But it's a big job and a big department. But clearly, from what that like interim guy was saying, it does sound like they've got a lot of stuff to sort out in terms of legacy and in terms of bureaucratic processes.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the thing as well, like I said, I wasn't going to bring it up, but it always crops into mind with HMRC stories. Like, you've got, at the same time, you've got things like, say, the IR35 reforms as well, which means the legislation and everything that the people who work for HMRC are trying to get their heads around while working under these conditions is changing all the time as well. So it just I don't really envy anyone who is having to work there at the moment, just in terms of the challenges around sort of the technology you've got access to. Like, say, working through a pandemic, we all know the challenges of that. And then, like I say, just the rules of the job change all the time as well, in terms of what you're supposed to be doing. It's a lot. There's lots of plates to spin in the air. But it's a really difficult job.
Yeah, I guess I was just saying that from that event, it does seem that they can work in an agile manner if they have to.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, though, Caroline, that, setting themselves up for a fall, weren't they, with that kind of big boast about going to be the world's best.
Yeah. Do you think they regret saying it now? Like, given, like, hindsight's 2020, I know, but just that, oh God, why did we come out with that?
Well, look, for all its faults, the British Civil Services has been making a lot of efforts in terms of neurodiversity. I did a quick Google search before coming on the podcast, and Civil Service has a dyslexia and dyspraxia network. It's been on the go for quite a while now. Claire, you're going to talk a bit about all the forms of neurodiversity and what's meant by that and how organizations can make the most of neurodiverse employees and stuff.
Yes, I am. So as I mentioned, we had a diversity and inclusion event in October of 2020. In the lead up to that event, we had several different workshops. I've talked about two of them on the podcast before. This particular workshop, which was run by neurodiversity coach and consultant Rachel Morgan Trimmer, was about hiring neurodiverse talent, why you should cater to them, and also just trying to give a little bit of an insight into what it feels like to have particular neurodiverse conditions. So I attended the workshop. It was quite interesting because she started out by, I think she sort of started off by saying, you know, like, oh, so did everybody read this thing that I sent you before the workshop so that we could all get prepared? And then when everybody sort of goes like, oh, no, she's like, well, no, because I didn't send you anything. And that's exactly the kind of panic that some people, you know, like feel like when they have ADHD or autism or dyslexia, dyspraxia, because you always feel like you're on the back foot in a way.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to that video. It is, yeah.
Yes, it's that's on Computer Weekly. Moment. Yeah, it's heart interesting. Yeah. It's really interesting, and I think one of the messages that came out from the workshop that I thought was very important is that a lot of companies think that it's going to take a lot of time, effort and money to implement changes that cater to neurodivergent people. But, you know, Morgan Trimmer pointed out that 60% of adaptations needed to help cater to people who are neurodivergent don't actually cost anything. And it could be, you know, being flexible, offering work flexibility, moving a desk, like little bits and pieces that actually don't cost anything but can make someone feel so much more comfortable in the workplace and therefore better able to do their job.
Yeah.
And then you also have the added benefit of being able to better cater to any clients or customers of your organization who might also be neurodivergent, in the same way that having lots of different minds in a room when you're brainstorming and coming up with ideas means that you're more likely to get a diverse set of ideas because you don't have just one mindset working on a project. It's a similar thing.
When I watched the video, and I haven't watched it all the way through, and piece of advice for listeners, do watch the video, not necessarily all at once because it is quite long, but you know, at least the first section would be really instructive. I just kept listening to her talking about dyspraxia and autism and ADHD and thinking, I've got elements of all these things. You know, it's not as different as from all of us as you might think. I mean, there are, you know, we can all be a little bit over focused on things and clumsy, which seems to be what dyspraxia means, kind of fine motor movements and things like that. She talks about that as being like a character in a rom-com, doesn't she, Claire?
Yeah, she does. And she also says that different people with these conditions, it all display in different ways and you'll have different elements of each one.
But she brings out all the kind of the plus points that come from all these conditions and the kind of extra creativity and
yeah,
so on and so forth.
that was one of the things that I really loved about this workshop, is that she focused so much on all of the positives.
So as someone who does cover diversity for Computer Weekly, do you say, like, neurodiversity, is that kind of an area that is gaining more coverage or interest, or is being talked about more widely within these wider conversations around diversity and inclusion at the moment?
I've definitely seen it talked about a lot more over the last couple of years. Yeah. Maybe not when I first started writing about diversity, but that alongside it stopped being just about getting women into tech, which I think is really important, because it isn't just about getting women into tech. I know that we're not done with that battle, but that's sort of chugging along now, and it's almost like we've got the ball rolling, and now we can use the progress that we've made in that aspect to talk about and work on other projects as well, including this. And I think that that's a real positive that I've seen over the last few years of covering this. But yeah, I wrote a blog post about it as well, about the workshop. So there's a blog post on what I learned from the workshop, and then also the workshop itself is on Computer Weekly. And obviously, yeah, obviously Rachel explains everything a lot better than me, and possibly a lot more eloquently worded as well, because you know, I am trying to work on language and making sure that I'm inclusive in the way that I talk about diversity topics, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah, it's always a work in progress. I think it's a work in progress that's really intensified during the pandemic and in 2020 because of the Black Lives Matters movement. I mean, and a lot of tech companies, I mean, we ourselves is kind of adjacent to tech, but also a lot of tech companies have been trying to kind of ramp up and improve their diversity. And diversity programs within their organizations right across the whole suite of it. It's one of the things that Gaurav Dhillon spoke to me about this week. So I did an interview with Gaurav Dhillon, who's the CEO of SnapLogic. That's his current berth. It's the third time that I've spoken to Gaurav. The first couple of times were more about his business, more about SnapLogic and what they do and stuff, and trying to find out customers, because it's Computer Weekly, as you know, listeners may or may not be interested in this, but we always try and approach IT through the lens of customers and not talk too much about suppliers. But so I've spoken to him about his SnapLogic before. Basically, they do, I'm simplifying, but they basically join up applications and data in the cloud. So it's a platform as a service play. And it's kind of related to the thing that he's most famous for, maybe, which is he was one of the co-founders of Informatica. And Informatica is quite a kind of, well, SnapLogic is too, but Informatica back in the day was one of the kind of original big beasts of the data world. So it was interesting to have a more personal chat with them. I'm going to be writing a profile of Gaurav. Educated in India, engineering student. He said he considers himself blessed to have, in the 80s, gone down the software engineering route as opposed to civil engineering, which is what his parents had expected him to do, like respectable civil engineering. But he went down the software route, came to the US, as a lot of Indian students at that time were doing, really in search of a scholarship. India being a very poor country at that time, still is in many respects, but in the 80s, very poor country, he said. So he went to graduate school, did computer science, kind of dropped out of graduate school and joined Unisys. So his parents by this time were tearing their hair out because he'd gone to graduate school, dropped out of that, and then he had this job at Unisys, and then he left that in 1992 to try and strike out on his own. the nutshell analysis is that he felt that the company was struggling to go from the mainframe world to the applications, more Windows-driven kind of world. And so he wanted to set up something with his friend, which he did, that would address the whole business of companies migrating their applications onto more distributed computing environments. His friend Diaz Nezamani. And they founded what became Informatica. So in some ways, this is a classic Silicon Valley story in that they didn't start off aiming to have a data integration company. It came, some of the peripheral stuff they were doing coalesced and gave them the idea that data integration was important, because at that time you had kind of source systems feeding data warehouses, and then you extracted business intelligence from those data warehouses. But how would you get the data into the data warehouse in the first place? So data integration was the idea. And he drew for me his business plan. He drew it on a napkin for one of their early investors. It's literally what he did in a Palo Alto coffee shop. And he did it very quickly for me. And you could see like the missing piece, the data integration piece. And the venture capitalist gave them the money. They wrote them a check. These two young Indian blokes, check for $2 or $3 million. He told me how they went to deposit it at a branch of Bank of America. And he expected like lights to go off and sirens to blare and the police to come in. But no, they just took his check. But there was some basic stuff they didn't know, like you had to have a money market account and the share structures and things like that. So they were doing a pivot, and they were also learning very much kind of as they went along, which is, yeah, it's kind of interesting, kind of inspiring. I think it's a real, it's a great US immigration success story. The story of Indians in Silicon Valley. I don't know what you both think about this, because it's kind of so obvious, but it's almost like embarrassing to kind of talk about it too much. The fact that there are so many successful, Indian people graduated from their great universities. They speak English very well because of the British Empire, right? I mean, that's why English is spoken so well in India. And it is a phenomenon. So I did ask him about that. There's that guy at Google Cloud, Caroline, isn't there? Thomas
Kurian,
yeah. And I think his brother also is quite a big figure in tech as well. So yeah.
Last time, because I don't really cut, and this is just an insight into how Computer Weekly works and how the different companies are carved up. But yeah, I think his brother was at NetApp, possibly a CEO as well. So a family business is definitely tech, basically.
It's a real phenomenon. I asked Gaurav about it, to reflect on it. He said, that's a big topic. And there must be like books and PhDs and stuff being written about this. But his way of talking about it was to say there was kind of two generations. So there's guys like him who kind of came over in the late 80s. And they founded Informatica kind of 92, 93, and they got their VC money first round in 95-ish. But they basically came for the scholarships, to continue their education that way. But you said there's a more recent generation that's more of an effect of cross-border globalization, kind of younger generation of Indians coming into Silicon Valley. But he said, look, it's not something that's been planned, between the United States and India. It's just a function of kind of migration patterns, and also following the geography of IT and the kind of globalized nature of IT. So founder of Informatica, and then he left Informatica after about 12 years. Gentleman's agreement, they went in their separate ways. He said he was quite tired because they'd been kind of working 24/7 for 12 years, so, and longer actually. So he took some time out, and he had obviously a very wealthy man by this point, came back and made a couple of other investments, one of which was SnapLogic, which I've mentioned. but also he was lured into B2C. He founded a company called Jamon, who did video on demand, about at the same time as the foundation of SnapLogic. This was 2006. And I joked that he nearly invented Netflix. And he does know the Netflix guy, Reed Hastings. But he did say, look, he said, I will say that he's very proud of being the first person to show high definition video on a laptop at the Cannes Film Festival. Because at that time, people were saying, this is crazy talk. No one's going to watch a movie on a laptop. Who would do that? Anyway, that business didn't work out. He said the 2008 crash put the kibosh on it. So he's stuck with, so far, he's stuck with our world of B2B and my particular world of data with SnapLogic. Yeah, but interesting guy to talk to. And he had some tips. I mean, if our, some of our listeners out there maybe would be tech entrepreneurs, want to do their own startups. So he had some top tips for them. The main thing he said was, or one of the things he said was, it's going to be harder than you think. So don't choose something that you're not passionate about, because it's just not going to work. So have a passion for it. Choose your co-founders very carefully. That's very important to get that initial chemistry of the board, he said. And interestingly, he said, in his view, it's very hard to do that virtually. You know, so from a pandemic point of view, that's kind of relevant. So you can do the scaling up and stuff, but in terms of initial foundation, that has to be, well, it doesn't have to be, but it's better if it's face-to-face. And in terms of the pandemic, I asked them, well, Silicon Valley, how's it maybe going to change as a consequence of the pandemic? He said, I think like all of us, he wants it to be over. He said he'll interestingly, he said, in future, I will go back, you know, I will work from home. And then he said, one day a week. So he is going to work in the office 4 days a week because he's, you know, prefers all the face-to-face stuff and so on.
What if nobody else is in the office because he's the only one that's decided to go back to work 4 days a week?
Well, that's a very good question, Claire. I don't know what would happen in that case. And he puts a lot of stress on company culture as well. He can't have a company culture on his own, can he?
You could. You'd get exactly the culture you want to cultivate because you're the only person. Yeah, it could be very successful.
A lot of people would argue that company culture, sometimes flexibility, work flexibility plays into that. But then you also are meant to lead by example. So what if he's creating a company culture where there's presenteeism because you have to come into the office because the boss is in the office?
Yeah. I think that's a very good point that he really should be thinking about. I might get back to him about that because I was a little bit taken aback when he said he was only going to work from home 1 day a week. I'm like, really, dude?
I would actually quite like that if you could go to him and just like, hi, just reflecting on our talk, I've got some notes for you on how to be a CEO. You want to sit down and write this up, please, sir?
Yes. Yeah, company culture. He said that's so important. And he used that. There's that Peter Drucker phrase of culture eats strategy for breakfast. It just overrides other things so much. And he, you know, we could say that, anyone could say that, but someone who's built two companies, I think saying that is reasonably significant. It said an interesting thing, I thought, in terms of the sociology of the Bay Area, and this would actually be true of London and other cities as well. He said that tech workers in the Valley who are maybe late 20s, getting into their 30s, maybe thinking about like having a family and stuff. But because it's so expensive, you know, because Silicon Valley, San Francisco is so expensive, they've not bought houses yet. He suspects a lot of them will go back to where their parents or grandparents are and just work remotely and do that from Zoom. He thinks there's going to be a rebalance. He speculates that there will be a kind of a bit of a rebalancing.
Kath actually wrote an article that talked about whether salary will be reflected in that move away from cities.
Yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of kind of changes in terms of geography and where people live and how they'll be remunerated differentially and stuff. He was very optimistic about the future, these people often are. He thinks it's just going to be so much pent-up opportunity and energy that's been a bit suppressed by the pandemic that, you know, a lot of that's going to flourish. And I guess just to close on Silicon Valley, it just says it has to grow up, you know, stop being so nerdy and engineering focused and building faster, better things, and kind of reflect on some of the ethical issues and what an ethical AI system would look like, and some of the stuff that we've discussed on our podcast too in the past. I enjoyed my conversation with Gaurav. I'll be writing that up, and I will have a link to that when it appears in the article for the podcast, and we'll have links to all the other stuff that we've spoken about today. And yeah, check out that video. And you can read that article on computerweekly.com. And you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. Sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week. Yes, it is. So it just remains for me to say, as always and ever, thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
Thank you to you, listener, for listening. Okay, stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.